It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, U.S. Representative Ron Kind, a Democrat from La Crosse, joins us to give us his take on the biggest issues facing Congress.
First, health care and a tax overhaul are still on the table in the U.S. Senate. The nominee for the new head of the Drug Enforcement Agency is out, and Steve Bannon is warning Senate Republicans that they could face primary challenges.
Those are just a few items in a busy week in Washington. Paul Singer joins us now for a look at the latest. He's Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob, how you doing?
Well, good. Now, let's start with this healthcare story that went from big news to nothing, it looks like now. A bipartisan duo of senators, Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray, Republican and Democrat, they said, hey, we got this compromise. We'll bring back these subsidy payments that the president got rid of, give the states more flexibility. People seemed happy. The president seemed happy. Now everybody hates the plan. What's going on?
Well, I don't know. What time is it?
Yeah, I mean, that's how it's
really
been today.
It's been all over the place today. At one point, in a 24-hour period, basically, both, you know, the president seemed enthusiastic, and then he seemed unenthusiastic this morning, and then the Republican leadership seemed enthusiastic yesterday, and then they seemed unenthusiastic today. Then a little while ago, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was at the podium, seeming unenthusiastic, but not saying actually no, saying, well, you know, the president wants, you know, to tighten it up a little bit, maybe make some fixes. I honestly have no idea what's going on. I say that as somebody who spent most of the day watching this thing. It is very, very clear that everybody in Washington is concerned, including, I think, the president, about what happens if the subsidy payments collapse and therefore premiums increase dramatically for low-income people trying to get insurance on the markets. But they don't seem to yet have an answer because the president also doesn't want to be seen just giving, as he says, a bailout to insurance companies. Now, what Patty Murray and Lamar Alexander will say is this is not a bailout to insurance companies. This is essentially a bailout to low-income health insurance consumers. But, we don't know at any given moment what the president's mood on this is going to be. So we don't know at this point whether this is a real thing or not.
Now, assuming the status quo at this second Central Time stays as it is, the subsidy payments that President Trump canceled, they don't come back. Premiums
right.
do go up. It seems like some of the talk now is who gets blamed. President says it's just showing more failure of Obamacare. Democrats are saying this is showing that you're sabotaging Obamacare. If it stays this way until election 2018, is this something they're still going to be battling over then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Let's assume status quo at this moment that this thing does not pass and the subsidy payments do end. If, in fact, people begin to see significant price increases in their insurance early next year, that will be news, and people will be complaining about that. And it doesn't matter who you want to blame. The fact of the matter is that if people start to see significant price spikes, it will not be good for the president and the Republicans in Congress who control both Congress and the White House. It's the same as gas prices. You know, we always talk about this. Gas prices go up and down, essentially independent, completely independent of anything the president can do, and yet the president always gets blamed when gas goes to $4 a gallon.
And people have been pointing out, I think you were one of the people I'm thinking of here, Paul, that this seems to be a trend with President Trump. He takes an action that puts something that some people want in peril, whether it's these subsidies or the on immigration, the deferred action for childhood arrival recipients. He makes a change and then basically kind of throws the ball into Congress's court saying, this is going to break now unless you fix it. Is this an intentional tactic on the president's part, do you think?
I think so. I mean, again, hard to read the tea leaves of the guy, but it is clear that there are things he wants to say he has done, and he wants to say he's repealed and replaced Obamacare. He wants to say he's broken gotten out of the Iran deal. He wants to be able to say, he has, for instance, gotten the U.S. out of the Paris climate talks. You know, he wants to be able to say he's redone NAFTA. But a lot of those things are not really done. What he does is he kind of opens the can, but he doesn't actually sort of dump the beans on the floor. So that's the next question, is what do we do now? And he basically hands it all to Congress. The thing that is sort of interesting about this is that, and I think that I said on Twitter a couple of days ago, that, you know, Congress at the moment is the least competent branch of government. They can't legislate on much. So now the president is just adding to the pile of things they're supposed to be legislating on. They've got to do something on DACA. They've got to do something on the Iran deal. They've got to do something on these health insurance subsidies. It's like the number of things they've got to do something on is getting longer and longer, while Congress is getting no more competent to actually do any of it.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. We have a lot of cans of beans to dump on the floor here, Paul. Let's move on to a tax overhaul. Republicans working on this. Step one, passing a budget, apparently, and then that would open the door to a tax system overhaul. How are they doing at this point?
Well, again, what time is it? At the moment, what the Senate appears to be succeeding in doing is lining up the votes to pass this budget outline. Budget outline is step one. It is the thing that basically says, yes, you've got $1 trillion to spend on this stuff, and yes, you can do it with only 50 votes. You don't need any Democrats. They have to pass that thing first, that outline first. And it looks like they've got the votes they need to do that at the end of this week. That is only step one. The remaining steps are no easier, because then you have to get to a point where you actually draft a tax bill. You actually have to provide in that bill to cut taxes for a lot of people, but you're going to increase taxes on other people. This is the dirty little secret here. Not everybody gets a tax cut. And the people who don't get a tax cut and see their taxes actually increase are going to be mad about that. So then you have to see, can I pass this bill with a lot of people mad? And then, of course, you have the sort of more philosophical question about, can you really pass a tax bill that essentially says it doesn't matter if it increases the deficit by $1 trillion, because the economy is going to grow so fast and so vigorously over the next few years that it'll wipe out all that deficit. That's basically the gamble the Republicans are preparing themselves for, and there may be some people who balk at that in the Congress.
A lot of people are watching what Senate Republicans do on the issues we've talked about so far. One of those people is a fellow named Steve Bannon. You reported on him this week, White House strategist, former White House strategist. He spoke to conservatives this week, and he had a message for Senate Republicans.
All of you folks that are so concerned that you're going to get primaried and defeated, you know, there's time for mea culpa. You can come to a stick and condemn Senator Corker. And you can come to a stick, a microphone, and you can say, I am not going to vote for Mitch McConnell for majority leader.
So you reported on this, Paul, more on Steve Bannon's message for those Senate Republicans.
You know, the funny thing about that Bannon quote, which I love so much, is that, you know, here is the consummate outsider. We're coming for you. We're coming for you. We're bringing the pitchforks. We're coming for you. But in so doing, he says you can come to the stick, which is insider talk. That is actually the language we use, sticks and stills. It means the microphones and cameras will be able to come to the event, but not all of the reporters and not all of the video people. Again, sticks and stills. So here's the consummate outsider fight, right? But cast by a consummate insider. It's kind of bizarre. But, yeah, this is a guy who was the president's right-hand man, that is the Republican president of the United States, basically declaring war on the Republican leadership in the U.S. Congress and saying that if you are refusing to denounce Mitch McConnell, we are going to primary you and we're going to try and kick you out of the Senate. It's stunning.
Is this year ripe, or next year, I guess, ripe for successful Republican primaries? Because, you know, there are fellas named Cantor and other big names who were successfully primaried out of their Republican congressional seats. Then there's a fella named Paul Ryan. There was a lot of excitement about his primary challenger last year. Didn't lose a lot of sleep over that, I don't think. What do you see happening next year?
You know, The fact of the matter is that all politics is still local, and so each one of these races is distinct. The Eric Cantor race is a very different animal. That was blindsiding everybody, with the exception of my next-door neighbor down in Culpeper, Virginia, who told me it was coming, and I wasn't paying any attention, because he had been to, like, some local county political convention where Cantor's people got, you know, kicked out of the room or something. Every one of these is local. Now, how strong is the candidate that Bannon is backing? Some of these candidates might be strong. Some of them might be a little freaky. You know, we have already seen in Alabama that the Bannon-backed candidate, Roy Moore, beat the McConnell and Trump-backed candidate, a guy named Luther Strange, an incumbent senator, in a Republican primary. So, we think it's possible. I mean, clearly, Roy Moore has shown it's possible that these pitchfork-type insurgent Republicans can unseat the incumbents. But we also don't know in each state how good the candidate's going to be. We don't know how good the environment's going to be, and we don't know ultimately what Trump's brand is going to be either. Given, as we were talking about earlier, you know, how good's the economy, how your job's improved, is your insurance going up, stuff like that.
We're talking to Paul Singer from USA Today, looking at the top stories in a busy week of national news.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see primary challenges to Republican senators in the 2018 elections? And do you think there should be a bipartisan compromise on health care in the U.S. Senate? You can call us at 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation right now with Paul Singer from USA Today, looking at the top stories in national politics.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the top story in national politics today? I had 8 or 9 to choose from. I'm interested to see what you are watching right now out of Congress, out of the White House, in the courts, for that matter. And are you looking for some kind of bipartisan reform of health care, changes to the Affordable Care Act, tax reform? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Paul, what I thought at one point was going to be our lead story today, we had a nominee for the Drug Enforcement Agency, Congressman Tom Marino. He withdrew from that nomination after his connections with the drug industry were profiled in a 60 Minutes Washington Post report. What in this report scotched the deal for him?
Well, the basic gist of it is that the congressman supported a piece of legislation. I don't know the details of it completely, but the long and the short of it is the legislation made it easier for people to prescribe opioid prescriptions, and it made it harder for states to intervene, basically, and cut down on the number of opioids being sold in their state. Well, the report from the Washington Post and I believe it was 60 Minutes, right? There's a whistleblower at the DEA who said, essentially, we told everybody all along that this legislation was going to flood the market with opioids and make it a lot harder for us to stop opioid addiction. And lo and behold, that is what has happened. And Congressman Marino should have known better, basically, is the argument, and did know better and chose to ignore it because he was being pressured and funded by lobbyists for the drug industry that make this stuff. And it was a pretty damning report. A damning report, not necessarily for a regular member of Congress, although it would certainly raise some questions about what the member of Congress was doing, but a damning report really for somebody who's supposed to be the drug czar responsible for stopping opioid addiction. So it was pretty clear once this thing came out and President Trump was asked about it and said, we're looking into it. The time clock on the Marino nomination at that point began to count down, and then early in the morning, whatever day it was, a couple of days ago, he withdrew.
And we've seen some withdrawals of nominations and some people who did go into key positions in the administration, lots of them, and leave. Does this seem like more than usual this far, less than a year into an administration?
Well, yeah. I mean, they're already through a couple communications directors and a chief of staff. There is the HHS secretary had to step down, Tom Price. because he was found to be using charter flights, which were not illegal, but were sort of bad optics, as we say here in Washington. There is some conversation that the president has not severed ties with Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, largely because they don't want it to look like there is some kind of chaos going on in the White House. And you know, giant turnover. Steve Bannon, of course, was a headline when he left, was the senior strategist in the White House. So, you know, there has this has been an unusually unsettled White House, I think is the fair way to put that. I don't lay blame for that necessarily. I don't argue that it's necessarily even bad. That's not my job. But it definitely has been more of a revolving door than you normally see at the White House at this stage.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today about the big stories in national politics. Here's one that's been breaking over the last day or so. A story, it started a couple weeks ago now. Four U.S. soldiers killed in Niger. They were advisors there. A question at a press conference yesterday to the president about his response. He says he'll be calling them, getting in touch. No other presidents before had done that. Let's start at that point, because a lot of people raised red flags with that.
Yeah, this is part of the Trump's unforced error strategy. I mean, he has this odd habit of doing and saying things that start fires that are really unnecessary. And there was absolutely no reason for him to say this, that other presidents had not reached out. I'm doing a better job reaching out to these military members than others. All he had to say was, you know, I'm terribly sad about this tragic event. I am reaching out to those families. I haven't reached out to them yet because of, you know, some issues about identifying who they are, whatever you want to say, and then just move on. But instead, he adds this little coda that, Obama didn't call everybody. And the Obama people, of course, went nuts, and everyone else has, you know, now indicated that Obama reached out to most of these people, I think through either phone or the rest of them by letters. And then Trump adds to the fire by saying, oh, yeah, we'll talk to General Kelly. That's his chief of staff, whose son died in combat. Well, why are you dragging General Kelly's son into this thing? The guy was a hero. General Kelly himself was a hero. It just goes off the rails. And then, of course, there's this bizarre episode where the president then calls one of these families and, depending on whose interpretation you believe, says something that the family takes offense to. If it is true, what the president was saying to them is, well, you know, he knew what he was signing up for, which is a little bit callous. Now, the president disputes having said that, sort of. He then goes on Twitter and says, by the way, the odd fact here is that when the president was talking to the family, there was a Democratic congresswoman in the car because they were pals. So the Democratic congresswoman is the one who reports Trump's comments. So now Trump is on Twitter attacking the Democratic congresswoman for saying that's not what I said, and more unforced errors coming. I've got proof. Well, now what? Are we going to get into one of these questions like, are there tapes? I mean, it just becomes this carnival of errors.
And the Washington Post called Gold Star families with service members who had passed away. One of them reported that the president, a father of a soldier who fell in Afghanistan, President Trump had offered, has said he'd send him $25,000 and sort of fundraiser for him, which the father says has not happened yet. So, I mean, unprecedented is an easy word to throw around. This is the kind of thing we haven't talked about before.
Right, and I've got no evidence on that.
Right, this is a father's statement to the Post,
right?
Yeah.
But it sounds a lot like Donald Trump. You know, there have been news reports. You know, David Fahrenthold over at the Post has been doing this for a couple of years now, tracking all of the times when Donald Trump said, I'm making a donation, and then doesn't make a donation. So I would be fascinated to see if that turns out to be true. I can't verify it. But, yeah, again, I will say this, which I hope is not seen as a casting judgment on the president, which is not my job. He has struggled with this empathy thing. He has struggled with the ability to figure out how to properly show empathy and grief with the fallen. It has not come natural to him, and it is continuing to be a headache for him and his press people.
One more story I want to get to before we run out of time. Some new info out, a draft that former FBI Director James Comey had written, a letter that would exonerate to Hillary Clinton over the email issues, but written apparently before the investigation was complete. What kind of responses have we seen to this?
Well, two different responses, which would not surprise you. Democrats and some people in the FBI say you should not be surprised by this. It was an investigation that had been ongoing. They were in the process of wrapping it up. It was pretty clear as they were getting down to the end that they really had not found a criminal activity. And the interview with Hillary Clinton was kind of a capstone, and so they knew pretty much already where this was going. So they were working on a draft. And the emails that the FBI has released do not show any of the text of the draft. They only show that the emails were circulating with kind of the subject line, hey, what do you think about this draft? The Republicans have a very different take on this, and you'll see this played out on Fox News and then some of the president's tweets, which is that this proves that Comey was not trying to actually investigate Clinton's email. It proves that Comey was trying to make this issue go away, so much so that he was drawing conclusions before the investigation was over and already trying to exonerate Hillary Clinton. Now, having not seen the contents of any of these statements, any of these drafts, who knows? And there will always be these two different sides. But at the moment, what we know is that they were working on, the only facts we have so far is they were working on or discussing a draft of the statement a couple months before they interviewed Hillary Clinton. We don't know what that statement said, and we don't know how far along they were in the investigation at that time.
We'll leave it there for now, Paul. Thanks for taking on this whirlwind tour through a busy week.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Man, I'm going to start charging you by the topic.
That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today, joining us for our weekly roundup of the top news in national politics.